I needed to save my family, everybody in that room. And that's what I was trained to do. I saw him and I went and got him.
Tales of heroism emerge from the Colorado mass shooting. It's Tuesday, November 22nd, and this is Here and Now Anytime from NPR and WBUR Boston. I'm Chris Bentley. In a few minutes, we'll check in on the World Cup after an upset win by Saudi Arabia. We'll also hear from some unlikely roommates, college students, and adults over 60 who are rooming together to split exorbitant rents. But first, retired Army Major Richard Fierro, who we heard a moment ago, was at Club Q in Colorado Springs Saturday night. He told reporters he went into combat mode when a gunman started shooting during the drag show Fierro was attending with his family. Police say Fierro and another man, Thomas James, helped take down the shooter, probably saving lives. Earlier today, Robin Young spoke with one of the many people grieving those killed and wounded. Pastor Alicia Erickson held a vigil Sunday night at her church just across town, the Pikes Peak Metropolitan Community Church, which was founded as a haven for LGBTQ Christians shunned by other churches in town because of their sexuality and gender identity. Here's Robin.
I want to hear a little bit about this history. I think it's worth reminding us that Colorado Springs used to be a sleepy town that became a magnet for some of these mega evangelical churches. Tell us about the role your church played.
We started in 1979, and it was a group of, as I understand it, because I wasn't in town when this happened, they found it in a garage, and they needed a space where they could be themselves and not have to choose between their gender identity and sexual orientation and their spiritual life. And ever since then, the church has been a sanctuary and an advocate for people all across the spectrum of the LGBTQI plus community. Mm-hmm. And there have been many things over the years that have come up, both locally and nationally, that our people have really taken to the streets for, to fight against, because they are anti-trans and homophobic.
Yeah. Well, that reflects a division in the town, one of which is probably reflected in other towns across the country. But mm-hmm. one thing that struck us about hearing from Major Fierro last night, here he was, a straight Army man with his wife, daughter, his daughter's longtime boyfriend. They were there to see the young man who was his daughter's childhood friend, who'd taken her to the prom and was now a drag queen. There were others in the club as well who were also straight, seeing their friends perform. You know, I think it's important to note, this isn't the story that we're often told. You know, we hear about hate and division, but this reflects a gay community there that has many allies. Tell us more about that.
It's absolutely true, and unfortunately, many of our allies don't get the credit that they deserve. Many people in the LGBTQ community have been coming out to their families, friends, coworkers, their churches, and as that happens over the years, people have changes of hearts, and they realize that, you know, hey, I know this person. This isn't the rhetoric that I hear about what a gay person is or a trans person is, and they are able to come to a place of acceptance and love because they love that person to begin with and they know them. Mm-hmm. And then they can transfer that ideally to other people in the community and come to accept and love us as well. And so it is, I also think that it is a generational shift that is happening. Although not in all communities, obviously, but there are more and more people who are reaching out and, you know, accepting the LGBTQ community and mm-hmm. coming to shows, being a part of our community, standing up for us, even in the midst of times where there's a lot of division and hate.
Yeah. Saving lives, in this case.
Absolutely.
Tell us about the letter of interfaith leaders, from interfaith leaders, drafted for the local paper there. I think it's the Gazette.
What
did you say?
We were, the local group has gotten together on various issues in the past, and Some of the local leaders felt very strongly that they needed to stand up and say something again in support of the LGBTQ community. And it's pretty strongly worded. It denounces violence, and it also denounces the rhetoric against gay, lesbian, bisexual, transgender, and especially transgender community, because they have been so targeted in the past few years by persistent and consistent political campaigning and rolling back of rights of trans folks. And so, and it's been happening all across the country. So the interfaith group drafted a letter quickly yesterday, and then everyone signed on, and I believe it's going to be coming out today or tomorrow. I'm not sure exactly. The people, not everyone can sign it because their faith communities are not actually supportive of the LGBTQ community. Even some progressive churches or, you know, more liberal or mainline denominations still do not allow their pastors to come out publicly in support of the LGBTQ community. So it's kind of a mix of things, you know, sometimes, you know, they might publicly be supportive, but not able to be publicly supportive.
Right. Well, we know you asked Focus on the Family, which is the conservative Christian group, which is based in Colorado Springs, to sign on. They did not. Pastor Alicia Erickson of the Peak Metropolitan Community Church in Colorado Springs, thank you. And we're so sorry for the grief that you're experiencing now, but so glad you're there. Thank you.
Thank you.
Coming up next, the World Cup is off to an exciting start, especially for Saudi fans who got to see their team take down Argentina. That's after the break. Upsets are something fans of any high-stakes sports tournament love to see, and fans in Saudi Arabia won't soon forget their national team beating soccer powerhouse Argentina today. Deepa Fernandez spoke with Kier Radnich, a reporter for World Soccer Magazine, who's in Qatar, about one of the biggest upsets in World Cup history.
So, kind of a shocker for Argentina. Saudi Arabia scored 2 goals in the second half to win. How did they pull this off?
Well, they pulled it off, really, because they had greater fighting spirit in the end. It was a game of two halves. Argentina led 1-0 at halftime, should have scored more. And after halftime, Saudi got 2 quick goals, and that really took all the spirit out of Argentina, and Saudi played as if their lives depended on it.
It was a very inauspicious start to what's likely Argentina's star player Lionel Messi's last World Cup. You know, how does the rest of the tournament look for him and for the team after this?
Well, that's why it was such a big shock, because this is the stadium at Lusail in which the final will be played. So it looked as if destiny was starting him here in the place he's going to finish. Argentina can still qualify. They're not knocked out of the tournament, but mentally and psychologically, it's a huge blow for them.
And we should say our own here and now resident soccer encyclopedia, Thomas, just told me that in 2010, Spain lost their first game but went on to win the World Cup. That was in South Africa. So don't despair, Argentina fans. But let's talk for a sec about Saudi Arabia. Is this the sign of a good cup for them?
It is. I mean, the great thing for them, they've only played in the finals 5 times before. I mean, Argentina have won it twice. So it's remarkable. Also, one of the unusual things about Saudi is that none of their players play outside the country. They all come from Saudi clubs. And in fact, 10 of the starting lineup come from the one club, Al Hilal.
Interesting. So let's focus for a minute on the U.S. soccer team. And I'm sure there were many U.S. soccer fans who are a little disappointed at the result of the first game. It was a 1-1 tie against Wales. What do you make of this start for the U.S.?
Well, I was at that match as well. And again, it was a game of two halves. U.S. were excellent in the first half. They were quick, sharp, cohesive. And then in the second half, Wales raised the rhythm of the game, and the US really just fell apart. So that although US should have been winning by more than one goal at halftime, in the end, maybe they were a little lucky just to hang on for the draw.
But they still have a chance, right? This draw doesn't mean they're out.
No, of course not. I mean, everybody plays three matches in the first round, so there's still lots to hope for, lots to cheer for.
All right, well, we will all be watching. Keir Radnage is a reporter for World Soccer Magazine. He's lucky enough to be in Qatar right now. Thank you so much, Keir.
It's a pleasure.
Deepa also checked in with Borzu Deragahi, international correspondent at The Independent, about how Iranian fans and players are supporting the protest movement in their country while at the World Cup in Qatar. Yesterday, members of the Iranian soccer team stood defiantly in silence before their opening match, refusing to sing or celebrate as their country's national anthem played. Fans in the stand instead sang the pre-revolutionary anthem, and some wore t-shirts saying, "Women, Life, Freedom." Protests in Iran have been going on for 2 months following the death of 22-year-old Mahsa Amini in police custody. Here's Borzu's conversation with Deepa.
Well, I think it was very dramatic. For days, even several weeks before that first match that Iran played in, there was calls from the opposition, especially those abroad, for the players to boycott the game. The players were called traitors because they were participating in the game. They met with the despised president of the country, Ibrahim Raisi, just before flying to Qatar for the game. And so there was a lot of disappointment with these guys. And yet at this crucial moment, when the eyes of the world were upon them, when lots of people who are not following international politics what's happening in Iran were, you know, glued to their televisions watching this match, they kind of came through and had this very, very subtle yet very effective symbolic act of just remaining silent while the anthem of the Islamic Republic was being sung.
Yeah, I mean, their faces were stoic. I found it really powerful. Do you think they're going to face consequences when they return home?
I'm sure they will, to some extent. These guys are kind of big fish. They're big, spoiled, pampered athletes, many of them playing in European leagues. So, you know, they're not going to be, you know, dumped into a dungeon right away. But what it might mean is that, for example, they'll be charged with various crimes and then dragged through the courts. They might be prevented from certain privileges. They may be barred from things that they want and so on. In the past, prominent people have been charged with crimes for showing support for the opposition, including athletes and actors and people in film and so on.
I mean, we've just seen two really well-known Iranian actresses arrested for supporting the movement, for posting photos of themselves on Instagram without their headscarves. Just tell us quickly about that.
Yeah, I mean, this is a phenomenon that has been going on for weeks and weeks. You have people in film, you have people who are directors, and so on. As a matter of fact, the head of the Film Association came out today saying that so many of our people are being arrested and detained for these acts of defiance that we're trying to speak to the security forces and resolve this matter in a kind of calm way. These acts of defiance, in a way, among even the elite, have somewhat gone viral. And the regime is just trying desperately to scare people into not doing them anymore.
And do you think that's working? I mean, the more prominent people that do this, soccer players, actresses, do you think they can, that the regime can crush this movement?
I don't think that they can crush this movement. It's hard to predict what's going to happen because we've never seen anything like this in Iran. Usually there's protests, they go on for a few weeks and then they're crushed or they resurface and so on. What we've seen in Iran is like almost 10 weeks of sustained daily acts of protest, escalating sometimes. Sometimes the magnitude is very high, sometimes it's lower. You've seen just, you know, incredibly dramatic scenes all over the country. You've seen unity between different, often competing ethnic and religious groups and so on. And it's kind of unprecedented. So it's very hard to predict what will happen and whether the regime can survive this.
Borzu Daragahi is the international correspondent at The Independent. Thank you so much, Borzu.
It's been a pleasure.
After the break, how some college students and older adults are moving in together to save on rent. Stick around.
More college students in the U.S. are having trouble finding stable housing. About 43% of students at four-year universities experienced housing insecurity in 2020, according to a survey by Temple University. At the same time, more senior citizens are struggling to make ends meet, and one out of every four adults over the age of 60 is living alone. So with younger and older generations in a bind, why not have them live together? It's not a new concept, but it hasn't been widely investigated or normalized in this country. Now the trend is rising globally, and a couple of programs in the US are picking up steam, including one in Southern California called Homeshare OC. 19-year-old Natalie Ho is a participant. She attends Irvine Valley College and studies psychology.
I pay $300 a month for my room, which is pretty affordable for me.
She lives with homeowner Arlene Casimiro, who's 89 years old and a longtime widow in Dana Point, California. And we passed the mic to Natalie to ask Arlene if there are any downsides to living together.
I have no dislike about you. You know, I didn't like the sink of dirty dishes last week when I got up in the morning.
Well, it won't happen again.
We had to talk a little bit about housekeeping or house cleaning, whatever. Not house cleaning. I don't ask her to do house cleaning.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I don't dislike Natalie at all. She has a nice, bubbly personality, and she shares with me when she's going in and out, which is good to know.
For more on the program that matched these two roommates, we have its founder. Kerry Buck is also Executive Director of Homeless Intervention Services of Orange County. Kerry, welcome to Here and Now.
Thank you for having me. I'm glad to be here.
So one of the big reasons you started this home sharing program is to prevent homelessness among college students and seniors. And I want to hear about that in a moment. But first, I'd love to hear your reaction to what we just heard from roommates Natalie Ho and Arlene Casimiro. They almost sound just like typical roommates having disagreements about chores. What were you thinking when you heard it?
I thought it was exactly like the other matches that we have had. They get along so well, and they're learning to live together.
So tell us more about the program. It's called, as I said, Homeshare OC. It got started right around when the pandemic did, and that slowed you down a bit. But how did you land on this as a solution to housing issues among these two groups?
Well, I've been working in the homeless field in Orange County for almost 10 years, and we started to see an increase in students and seniors. So it just became an idea that I thought about doing in Orange County because I had heard about it in other parts of the world. It just is not normal for Orange County.
Now, how does home sharing work right there in Orange County?
Well, what we have is a website and a platform where students can sign up or they can talk to their university or college and will be referred to us. They fill out a simple application. The homeowners do the same. They fill out a simple application, and then from there we contact both of them and start working that relationship. It takes a lot of trust to get to the interest to actually moving in together. So that's where our job really comes in, to find out what each of them have interests in and then start that matching process. So we might have a handful of students and homeowners, but what is it that would make them a good fit? So we go through both of their applications and look at something that might stick out for us. And then we introduce them to each other by phone and by Zoom and then in person. And then they finally make that decision if they're going to move in together.
And the rent the student pays maxes out at $500 a month. Also, it sounds like what we know about the benefits of programs like yours are somewhat anecdotal. For example, Natalie was telling us how she's always wanted to live near the beach, and she's now been able to check that off her bucket list this semester by moving in with Arlene in Dana Point. And she only spends $300 a month on rent, which has been a huge lifesaver for her.
I do not feel like I'm missing out on anything as a college student by doing this, because it doesn't stop me from, like, you know, going out, going to parties, but not, I don't need to host them to experience them, you know, like, it hasn't stopped me from anything except for student debt.
You know, producer Ashley Locke and I were just looking at rooms for rent in Dana Point, which is a beautiful part of the Southern California coast. And let's just say somewhere as much as five times the $300 that Natalie is paying. So along with, you know, this cost saving, what else are you hearing about benefits?
In addition to the cost savings, it is about companionship. You mentioned that we have 25% of homeowners or seniors that are living alone, and that really is the key right there. Our college students experience a lot of loneliness when they're moving off to college, they're going to school. You don't necessarily think about it, but that really has been a key driver in students signing up for us.
You know, the benefit of that companionship you're talking about is something that Natalie shared with us too.
I get someone who kind of acts a little bit like a motherly figure. She's very, very sweet. I know I can go to her with anything. And it's like the motherly dynamic with none of the control or like punishment. It's perfect for me as an adult who needs guidance, but freedom at the same time.
So those are some of the wonderful things about the program. But on the flip side, there are some cons. We heard from someone helping run a similar program on the East Coast who's also been keeping tabs on this trend. Ernest Gonzalez is the director of the Center for Health and Aging Innovation at New York University, and he says there are pitfalls to this kind of program. For one, ageism when it comes to recruiting older adults.
The good news is that we have hundreds of students interested in the program. The bad news is that not too many older adults are aware of this opportunity, or they have their own reservations of having a roommate, nonetheless a younger roommate.
So Gonzalez says that he's been eyeballing the ratio for some time, and it appears that for every one student that's interested in this program, they need approximately 15 older adults to maximize the match based on preferences like, you know, location, pets, smoking. But so far, it's been hard for them to meet that. Kerry, are you having similar challenges here in California?
We are having similar challenges, but we're also meeting some successes with individual conversations, getting out into the community and talking to different groups like women's clubs, Rotaries, Kiwanis clubs, all of those different groups that we get in front of and talk to. We typically will find one or two people in there that are interested.
Mm. You know, Gonzalez also says public policies have been a barrier.
There's so many low-income older adults that can benefit from this program, but they're living in public housing and or on means-tested public benefits that are income-based. Receiving income from a graduate student for shared housing may jeopardize the eligibility of receiving public benefits, so we are careful during the recruitment process.
Which just basically means if you get these few hundred dollars from a grad student, it could push you off your benefits. Are you coming up against that issue with older folks too, Kerry?
We haven't had too much of that yet. What we have had is, for example, we have one homeowner that's in a reverse mortgage, and so she's not allowed to charge rent. But that's okay because she has our students provide 5 hours of time. It could be as simple as watering plants, running to the grocery store, walking the dog. So they negotiate that out. The other ones we do keep an eye on just to make sure that it's not hitting any of their health benefits, their Social Security benefits, anything like that that would have an impact on them financially.
And that 5 hours of time for errands that you mentioned students do for homeowners is on a weekly basis. Looking forward, we know homelessness is a really big problem in Southern California. It's also one of the most expensive places to live in the entire country. I wonder if you think a solution like this, you know, outside the box, how urgent is it that, you know, something like this maybe scales up?
I think it's incredibly urgent. During the pandemic at our local college, which is very near to our city, the security guards actually opened a parking lot at the university so that students that were homeless could stay in their cars and be safe. As the pandemic has gone away, the number of homelessness now is starting to increase because all of our benefits have now gone away. So in the last few weeks, we went from 100 or so people contacting us a month looking for shelter, and in the last couple of weeks, it's bumped up to around 400. So it is really astronomical and is growing now that we have no additional funding coming in as a response from the pandemic.
And is your organization able to meet or match 400 college students a month with seniors?
Right now, we can't meet the need of the college students that are contacting us. So it is incredibly imperative that we get out and speak to our homeowners and get in touch with them, communicate with them, and talk about the great need that, we have that they could help with and help get these college students in a safe space so that they can finish their college degree.
Kerry Buck is Executive Director of Homeless Intervention Services of Orange County, California. She's also running a roommate program that matches older adults with college students called HomeShare OC. Kerry, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you. I had a great time, and I really appreciate you highlighting what we're doing across the country with home sharing.
This podcast comes from the team behind Here and Now from NPR and WBUR Boston. Check out our website, hereandnow.org, for more stories, including our conversation with a snowplow driver in Buffalo who helped his neighbors in Western New York dig out from more than 6 feet of snow over the weekend. Here he is on a live stream he ran while clearing snow.
Hey, if any of you guys know how to do a snow dance to stop it from snowing, feel free. You could do that, and I'll return the favor somehow.
Today's stories were produced by Adeline Sear, Sam Rafelson, Thomas Danielian, and Ashley Locke. Todd Munt and Gabe Bullard edited the show. Technical direction today from Mike Moschetto and Max Liebman. Theme music by Mike, Max, and me. Our digital producers are Allison Hagen and Grace Griffin. The executive producer of Here and Now is Carlene Watson. Thanks for listening. See you tomorrow.